Okay, hi everyone. Welcome to the second talk of the day in the Core Information Group. We're very happy to have Supratha Potter from University of Ottawa here telling us about symmetries, graph properties, and quantum speedups. Please.
Thank you, Felix. I'm happy to be here giving a talk. So today I'm going to talk about symmetries, graph properties, and quantum speedup. This is a joint work with Celeb Bendavid at University of Waterloo, Andrew Childs at University of Maryland, Andres Gillian at Caltech and Berkeley, William Krusmer at UT Austin, and Daochen Wong, he's also from University of Maryland. So basically the theme of this work is we want to understand when quantum computer can give a speed up over the classical one. So for instance, if you look at like these two types of problem, like we see like in one category, we have some of the problems like quantum simulations, period findings, factorings, or like discrete logs and all this kind of problems, we can have exponential speed up. So quantum computer can actually be exponentially faster than the classical one. But on the other hand, there are some other problems, let's say unstructured search, collision problem, or let's say formula evaluations, or for instance, checking ST connectivity, like given a graph, given two designated node S and T, we want to check whether there is a path between S and T or not. For this kind of problems, we see that we only get polynomial speed up. So then it's very interesting question to know like why for some problems, quantum computer can give us exponential speed ups, while for the others it doesn't. So we actually explored this problem, but in query complexity setting. Now, most of the problems here can actually be formulated in query complexity settings. And in the query complexity settings is a nice framework to design quantum algorithm. So let us see what query complexity setting is. In query complexity setting, we ignore the processing time and we only consider the number of times input is read. So the more formally the model is this, let's say we want to compute a function, a Boolean function f, which is from n bit string to just one bit. And we are given an input to this function in this black box fashion. And what I mean by that is, we have access, Oracle access to an unknown string x, and the Oracle looks like this. So every time we query the Oracle with the index I, we get a bit xi back from that, from the index I. And we want to compute f of x this way. Now, obviously, we want to do it as efficiently as possible. So cost of the computation in such in this model is minimum number of bits that is needed to be queried to compute f of x. So just to give you one example, let's consider AND function. Now AND function is defined this way. It is AND function on n bits, and the function value of AND is one if and only if all the bit positions are one. Otherwise, the output is going to be zero. So think of it this way. We want to compute an AND on these bits, and these bits are hidden. We don't know which positions are zero, which positions are one. So let's say we start, our query algorithm start by querying this location, and it sees one. Now, obviously, the algorithm cannot stop because there could be a zero hidden somewhere else. So it cannot still decide whether the output is zero or one. So let's say it keeps going this way and then queries this position. And again, it's one. But now let's say after querying this position, the output is zero. So if this position has a zero, then we can immediately stop and we can say that output is zero. We don't need to query any further because we know that if there is a zero somewhere, then the output has to be zero for AND function. But there could be some other instance where, imagine this kind of input where the algorithm queried all the positions except one, and there are ones everywhere except this last position. And then we cannot still say what would be the output. So the value in this position would actually dictate what would be the output. So if it has a zero in it, the output would be zero. If it has a one in it, the output would be one. So what you are seeing here is a worst case input. And we want to designate the cost of computing a function in terms of the worst case input. So we say that the deterministic query complexity of computing any function f is the number of queries needed on the worst case input by the best deterministic algorithm computing f. And we typically denote it by d of f. Now, this is clear that d of f is at most n, because in worst case, we just need to look at like all the positions. Similarly, we can design randomized, we can talk about randomized query complexity and quantum query complexity. And then we can say the randomized query complexity of computing f is the number of queries we need in worst case by the best possible randomized algorithm. And in the case of quantum, we talk about it's a quantum query complexity of computing f by the best possible quantum algorithm. Now note that in quantum algorithm, you can actually do superposition query. So instead of just querying any particular location, we can, for instance, ask like a superposition of few locations, and we get an answer in the answer register. So this is query complexity model, and it is already known that when we talk about like what could be the relation between quantum and randomized or like deterministic query complexity, so there is this result in this direction by Beals, Burman, Cleave, Mosca, and Deulf that for all total function, classical and quantum query complexities are actually power 6 related. So they are polynomial related. So for all total functions, we cannot have exponential speedup. And this result was recently improved actually this year by Aronson, Bendewit, Kothari, and Tal. They improved this to power 4. So here you are seeing that this theorems are telling us that we cannot have, for total functions, we cannot have super polynomial speedups. But then on the first slides, we have seen that there could be functions for which we can have exponential speedup. So what is the catch here? The catch here is that all those problems with exponential speedup, they're actually partial functions. And this theorem is talking about total function. So what is a partial function? So a partial function, so a function, we call it partial, if it is defined on a domain P, which is strictly a subset of all possible input. So in the sense that we are not, this function is not defined on all possible inputs, but rather like sum of the inputs of all possible inputs. So then the question is like, okay, like we know that for total functions, we cannot have exponential quantum speedup, but how about we check out like some of the inputs, and then the partial functions that we get, does it give exponential or super polynomial speedup? Can we always get such exponential speedup? So let us see that with one example. So let's consider the AND function that we have just seen, but this time it's a truth table based on, let's say, four bits, x1, x2, x3, x4. And let's say we decide to delete some of the entries. So if we delete some of the entries, then we get a partial function. The question is, can we then say this function has super polynomial speedup? Now, it actually turns out that no matter how you delete entries from the AND function, we can never get super polynomial speedup. So this was a phenomenon which was noticed by Aronson back in 2003, and then later it was formalized by Aronson and Bendewit in 2016. They said that there is no way for us to delete some of the entries from AND function and get a super polynomial speedup. But just to give you like an explicit example, let's consider these two problems, which shows this contrast. Where in one hand, so both of these problems are actually promised problems, but one problem can achieve exponential speedup, but the other cannot. So the first problem is 2-to-1 collision problem. And in 2-to-1 collision problem, we have black box query access to the input of m to the n. So think of it as an array of length n, where each position can have 1 up to n, m numbers. And the promise is that we need to decide whether it is 1-to-1 or it is 2-to-1. And this problem, the query complexity of this problem, the randomized one, is actually theta of square root of n. And quantum query complexity is actually theta of n to the 1/3. So you can see that for this problem, the collision problem, we can actually, we cannot have super polynomial speedup. So they are actually polynomially related. And there's nothing special about this number two here. You can also plug in like any other number and you can get a similar bound. But on the other hand, if you look at like Simon's problem, now Simon's problem, it is defined this way. It is a function from n bits to n bits. And the promise is that f of x is equal to f of y, if and only if you take x, x or y, then it is either zero or it is some hidden string s. And we need to decide which one is the case. For this problem, however, there is an efficient quantum algorithm which can work in theta log n queries. But on the other hand, it can be shown that any randomized algorithm would require actually square root of theta square root of n queries. So we are seeing that for Simon's problem, there is an exponential speedup. So then the question is like, I mean, why for the first problem we don't get exponential speedup? On the other hand, for this this later problem, we are getting exponential speedup. Like, what is the difference between these two problems? It turns out that the second problem is much more structured, and this is the common phenomenon that we can notice in all the problems that exhibits exponential speedup. In the sense that all the problems which exhibit speedup, they are highly regular. And what I mean by that is they have, all these problems have some sort of global regularities. And in a sense, the quantum algorithm exploits that global regularity to harness the speedup. So we want to understand that, like what exactly is the structure. But before I go into the next slide, like do you have any questions? Okay, let us try to see, like, I mean, what's exactly the structure and what do we know about them? So in this direction, there is actually a result which says that we cannot have super polynomial speedup if the function is too symmetric. Now let me explain what I mean by that. So we say that a function, so let's say the function is a partial function, because we know that for total function, we cannot have anyway like super polynomial speedup. So we just focus on partial functions. So let's say a partial function f is defined this way. It is from a domain P to 0, 0, 0, comma n. We say this is permutation invariant if for all permutation pi coming from Sn, these two properties hold. The first property is if you take an input from the promise of that function and you apply a random permutation, any permutation from Sn, then you get back another input, which is also in the promise. And what does it mean by applying this permutation? It's basically you apply the permutation on the indices. So it actually changes it actually permutes the indices. So no matter how we permute the indices, this modified input lands inside the promise. And more importantly, the function remains invariant under the permutation. So after we apply this permutation, the function value still remains the same. One such example could be think of like a majority function. Let's say given n bits input, we want to check like whether the number of ones in the input is more than n by 2 or not. This is permutation invariant because no matter like how you shuffle all the zero ones in the input, it's still, if it has a majority number of ones, it still remains that way. Now we know that for all permutation functions, like all permutation invariant functions, randomized and quantum are actually power 3 related. And there is this result by Ambinis and Aronson from 2014, where they could get a power 7 relation. And 2 years back, Shayu actually improved it to power 3. So we know that, so we at least know that, okay, if the function is highly symmetric, then we cannot have a super polynomial speedup. In fact, they are power 3 related. But then the question is like, okay, what if they are symmetric, but not like symmetric under full symmetry? What if we try to relax the amount of symmetry? Then how does the function behaves, which are permutation invariant under those symmetries? So this is exactly the question we want to ask. Note that this time the difference is that this is exactly the same definition that we had in the previous slide. It's just that instead of Sn, now we want to talk about any other group G, like any other permutation group, such that a function is symmetric under G. So not Sn. And it still has the same property. You take the input, if it is in the promise, you take any permutation from G and we apply it to the input, and then you get it back inside the promise, and then the function is also invariant under the permutation. Then we want to understand like, okay, like can we now have a function which is maybe invariant under some symmetry which is not as symmetric as full symmetry? Then can we have expect like super polynomial speedup? One such example is actually very interesting property, which is called Grab properties. Now, Grab properties in the adjacent symmetrics model. So what I mean by that is we are given a graph as an adjacent symmetrics notation, and we want to check some property of the graph. So one possible property could be, let's say I want to ask given a graph whether it contains a cycle of length 5. And in this example, the output would be yes, it contains a cycle of length 5. Now, note that no matter how you relabel this graph, so for instance, here I'm relabeling B with D, like swapping the relabel, this property still exists. The property doesn't change. Another property could be like triangle finding. So if this graph already has a triangle, no matter how you relabel the graph, the property still remains. So graph property is something which is invariant under vertex relabeling. And this is much less symmetry. Let me explain why. Because a graph property is again, if we take a graph which is from the property, meaning it let's say it satisfies a property, then no matter how we relabel the vertices, the relabeled graph is also in the promise, and the function remains invariant. So the property still remains. So this is one example. Like for instance, as I just said, like if you exchange B with D, then the adjacent symmetrics looks different, but the property, the internal property of the graphs remains same. And let's say we have Oracle access to this graph, and by Oracle access, so we have Oracle access to this graph via this adjacent symmetrics notation, and an Oracle access looks like this. We ask the Oracle, what is the value at the position I, comma j, and it returns us what is the ijth entry of the matrix. And note that this is like much less symmetry than the full symmetry, because even though we have n square possible inputs in our adjacent symmetrics, but we can only permute the vertices, not the edges. So we have like n factorial symmetries instead of like n square factorial. So it's much less than all possible symmetries. So this kind of property is actually very, very interesting, because then it is talking about all possible graph properties that we want to study. And we are asking this question that if I'm given a graph in this adjacent symmetrics notation, can I expect a quantum algorithm to be faster than classical algorithm? And this was exactly the question which was asked by Ambinus, Childs, Liu in 2010, and later it was mentioned in a property testing survey by Montanaro and Diulf in 2013. And they explicitly asked this question, say that can we show that there exists an exponential speedup for any graph properties, whether it is in adjacent symmetrics model or in the adjacency list model, or can we at least say that this is not possible? Like, I mean, which questions can we solve? And they actually asked this question specifically about graph property testing problem. So graph property testing problems have one extra layers of constraints, which says that if you take any yes input and a no input, they have to be epsilon far apart. So they cannot be close. So they have to be epsilon far apart for a fixed epsilon. Then the question is, can we exhibit like exponential speed up, or can we at least discard such speed up? So let me explain our result. So our result is actually in this direction. In the first result, we actually showed that if the graph is represented in the adjacency matrix notation, then we cannot have super polynomial speedup. Meaning, and this also works for not just graph properties, but hypergraph properties. So for any K uniform hypergraph properties, randomized query complexity is actually upper bounded by quantum to the 3 to the K. Meaning, if the quantum is faster, then randomize is also faster. As a direct corollary for normal graph, we also get that randomized and quantum are power 6 related. So this says that if you represent the graph in adjacency matrix model, then we cannot expect quantum algorithm to perform significantly better than the classical algorithm. And this actually holds for other kind of symmetries, which are like directed graph symmetries, bipartite graph symmetries, and all that. So as you can see, this partially solves the question raised by Chai Liu and Ambinis. But this doesn't resolve the question about adjacency list model, like what happens in the adjacency list model. We actually also studied the problem in adjacency list model. And interestingly, here we can actually exhibit a function for which we get exponential speedup. So meaning, if you represent the graph in adjacency list model, then quantum algorithm can be actually exponentially faster. And moreover, this property is actually a property testing problem. So this is for a property testing problem, not just for a graph property problem. So together, these two results actually fully resolve the open question. But then most importantly, it is saying that whether we are going to get exponential speed up for graph properties or not, this will really depend on which model we are representing the graphs in. If it is an adjacency matrix model, then we cannot have exponential super polynomial speed up. On the other hand, if you represent it in the adjacency matrix model, then we can exhibit a function for which we can have exponential speed up. So it really depends on the implementation. Any questions so far?
Hey, Subhartha, I have a question.
Yeah, sure.
So I'm quite confused about the symmetry right now. So you mentioned that if you're given an input, then the function is invariant under all permutations.
Mm-hmm.
That's the symmetry.
So sure. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So now, where does the graph come in? If you could explain this again, sorry.
Sure. No problem. So for instance, if you go back here, mm-hmm. So the function symmetric under full all possible symmetry is this, right?
Okay.
But yeah. Then you can actually talk about like other form of group actions, which are not like all possible SN, but it forms a group, which is a subgroup of like SN. And graph property comes from the fact that look at like if you represent a graph in adjacency matrix model, right?
Mm-hmm.
So then what happens is any location, let's say B comma D, we know mm-hmm. that one permutation is actually changing it to D comma B, right? So the permutation is coming this way. Like, I mean, you are applying the permutation only on the label of the graph. And then that induce a labeling on that induce a permutation on the edges. So for instance,
so the inputs are on the edges, you mean?
So yeah, so the inputs are on the edges. So for instance, here, like if you have a you query like one location of the adjacent matrix, that gives you an edge. Mm-hmm. That gives you tells you whether the edge is present or not. But you are applying the permutation on the vertices.
Okay. I see. And the diagonal entries are always zero in the input, so you don't read them.
Yeah, you don't need to read them. Sure. Okay, sure. Like if the graph is a simple graph, then you know that there cannot be a self loop. So yeah, sure.
I see. So is the function invariant under all labelings which preserve a property? Like let's say you say.
So graph properties are actually defined that way. So you can actually no matter how you relabel, it remains invariant.
Okay. Cool. Right. All right. Thanks.
So that's right. Yeah. So even though like you query the edges, but when you do this permutation, you actually permute the vertices, and that induces a permutation on the edges for the graph properties.
Cool. Right. Thanks.
Okay. So now the third result is actually the third result that we have is actually going down the rabbit hole for other kind of group actions, because we understand what happens for graph properties, right, in the adjacency matrix model. But then what about like other permutation groups, right? What happens for those? Can we at least classify like all those group actions, permutation group actions, such that functions invariant under those group actions doesn't give you super polynomial speedups. So we could actually almost classify such problems, and we could say that permutation groups constructed out of hypergraph symmetries are essentially the only permutation group that prevents super polynomial quantum speedup. So when we talk about functions symmetric under any group actions, then you can essentially look at like whether the permutation can be constructed out of hypergraph symmetries or not. If it can be, then you can say that so that prevents super polynomial speedup. Otherwise, you can have super polynomial speedup. So let me actually in the remaining time, let me actually explain all these three results, which are these three results are sort of like disconnected. So let me explain it one by one. So first, let me explain what happens for graph symmetries in the adjacency matrix model, how we obtained this result that randomized and quantum query complexity are polynomially related. So this actually started with an observation from Chaillu's proof, and we saw that this can be extended to graph property case as well. So let me explain like how Chaillu could prove that at least for full symmetry, why randomized and quantum are power 3 related. So this goes like this. So let's say we are given again like an input, n-bit input, and our algorithm queries the positions of this input. And this can be seen as a box, like I put I to the oracle, and then it tells me xi. Now imagine, instead of sending query directly to this box or this box O, like the oracle box, I put another box which actually permute the index and then send this permuted index to the oracle. So then the question is, would the algorithm behave differently? So for all the functions which are actually symmetric under full symmetry, the algorithm wouldn't even know whether I put this box here or not, right? Because it is symmetric under full permutation. So from algorithm's point of view, these two scenarios are not different for all the symmetric functions. Now let us go one step further. How about we take a function alpha, which is defined from n bits to n bits, which is defined from like n to n, but with a small range r, meaning even though it is from n to n, here it could only map to fixed r possible values. So now let's say if I replace this box with alpha function, then would my algorithm know that I have actually changed this? Would it actually detect this scenario from this scenario? And in this direction, there is a result by Zandri from 2015. And this result says that distinguishing a random small range function alpha with, let's say, range r from a random permutation of pi coming from Sn, it requires omega r to the 1/3 quantum queries. So if you are making less than this amount of query, then you won't be able to tell whether you are given this box versus this box. So this is actually good, right? Because then if you cleverly choose r to be the quantum query complexity power 3, because imagine the function that we are solving, f, that is invariant under full symmetry, let's say that has a query complexity q of f, then if we choose the range to be q of power 3, then the algorithm wouldn't distinguish between this case versus this case. But then what it says is, because this function has a small range, I can have a randomized algorithm which can actually pre-process all those queries. So since it is only R locations, the randomized algorithm would actually go and store all those R values. And every time a query comes I, it can then know like what would be the output of alpha I, and it can just output from its repository that it has saved. So even any randomized algorithm can also do that. So that's why you get a randomized algorithm which is also like power like Q at most QF to the 3. So this was the main idea of Shayu's proof, and this is how he was getting like power 3 power 3 relation between randomized and quantum. So you can immediately see that, I mean, this also applies for graph symmetry, because you can also, graph symmetry is are nothing but if you're given an edge, let's say I comma j, and then if you apply a permutation on the vertices, what you are essentially getting is pi I comma pi j, right? So so now you can actually, instead of querying R locations, you just need to check all possible, you just need to query all possible pairs, right? So that's like R comma R position. So that's like R squared position the algorithm has to query, and it can store everything and then output from this. So this can be extended to graph property case as well. So then we actually fleshed out the idea, and then we said that for graph symmetry, so more generally, we can say that if distinguishing a random function with range R from a random permutation, so note that this time we are talking about a random permutation coming from G, not Sn. If this requires omega R to the 1 over C quantum queries, then quantum and randomized are power C related for any functions which are invariant under that G. And this basically, we basically show this via reduction to Sn, the case Sn. But whenever you talk about this case Sn, right, you can essentially use Zandri's result that I have just shown in the previous slide, like distinguishing between a small range function and a random permutation from Sn. But we realized that there is actually a much cleaner reduction that you can do to collision problem. And that's actually essentially, it's enough for our purpose. So we use this theorem instead. We said that there is a universal constant C such that any quantum algorithm distinguishing a permutation Sn from all string in DNR. And by DNR, I mean, imagine like a, if you take the small range function, think of it as an array, which is like n to the n array, and it has, the array has at most r alphabet. So it's just a different notation, thinking in terms of input array. Then any permutation coming from Sn and distinguishing it from any string of d n r must make at least r to the 1/3 over c queries. And the proof is actually very straightforward. So let me actually tell you the proof. So you know the collision problem that I've just explained like in the earlier slides. It's basically, so there I explained like 2-to-1 collision versus 1-to-1 collision. But note that here, what is a small range function, right? If we are given a range R function, and let's say my input size N happens to be a multiple of R, then this is essentially asking whether my input is n over r to one function or 1-to-1 function. So that's essentially the distinguishing between DNR from Sn. But then that is like a one sub instance of collision problem. So, and using collision lower bound, we can already say that this is omega r to the one third. And then there is this case where you can say like, okay, what if it's not a multiple of r, you just make it a multiple of r. So you just blow the input size by a little bit by dummy inputs, and then you use this n dash by r to one function versus like one to one function. So this is a straightforward reduction to collision function. So essentially, this is the main idea for graph properties. We defined something called well-softening permutation graph. So this is not very hard to see. It's basically all possible permutation all possible permutations groove for which if you take any permutation from G and distinguishing it with DNR, if it requires at least r to the 1 over a over b for any b and a, then we say that this is well-softening. So for instance, what it says is that if distinguishing any DNR from any permutation from G, if it is like polynomially related, then we say that this is well-softening. And then we could show that if your group actions that you are talking about, if it is well-softening, then we cannot have super polynomial speedup. More formally, like if G is well-softening collection of permutation group with, let's say, power A, so it's A coming from here, then you can say that for all functions, randomized and quantum are actually power A related. So let us see. Using this fact from the previous slide, we can clearly say that all the functions, like the set of symmetric groups, this is well-softening, right? Because all the functions invariant under full symmetry, we know that this is like power three related using the collision bound or using Zandri's result. Now I have one slide to just show you like how we can obtain like graph symmetries from them. Note that so what does this previous slide tells us? It tells us that in order to say that whether we can obtain let's say given a permutation group action, if I can show that this is well shuffling, then I by default know because of this theorem that randomized and quantum are polynomially related. So what we can show is that let's say there is some group action G, and we can do some transformation to it. And then we see that for few transformations, this property still remains intact. So let me explain what I mean by that. Let's say G is a group action which is acting on, let's say, this domain N, and we change it to H. Now H is acting on, let's say, N to the L. Okay, so we blow up the domain, and let's say this act this way. G acts on, let's say, domain D, which could be N. Then for any L, we can define GL. So it's a new group action, but it is based on G, which acts on this larger domain D to the L. This works acts this acts as this way. If you apply pi on I1, I2 to IL, this is essentially applying like pi on every position, like every coordinates. So you see that we can get like G to the L this way. And we can also restrict to have like G to the angle bracket L this way, which is nothing but having a domain like with G to the angle bracket L. But this time it is applying on only distinct tuples. So for instance, here it could be that I have a one here, I have a one here, which is not allowed for D angle brackets L. And then we could show that the group action that you are getting this way, let's call it like H, then the cost of distinguishing, like cost for a quantum algorithm to distinguish between any permutation coming from H and let's a small range function, which is R to the L, it is lower bounded by this cost. So you can relate the cost of G with this modified group action G to the L. And similarly for the angle bracket L, this is also related. Now, note that once you know this, you can actually directly apply it to get directed graph symmetry. Because what is directed graph symmetry? It is nothing but, imagine what is a directed graph, right? It is, there could be an edge from 1 to 2, and there could be an edge from 2 to 1 as well. So we can think of it as, but there is no edge from, like, let's say 1 to 1. So there is no self loop. So that's why directed graph symmetries are nothing but S angle bracket 2k, right? Where k is the number of vertices you have. And this 2 is telling us that it is a pair where you cannot have, let's say, I comma I. You can have any I comma j such that I and j are different. And then immediately using this result, we can say that this is lower bounded by sk over square root of r. And this we already know from collision bound. So using this two results, we can just say, like, directed graph symmetries. So directed graph symmetries are also well self-linked. So here what we are doing is we can prove that certain group actions are well self-linked, then using this, so we have a reduction using which we can also expand this set, and then we can say that there are certain other sets which are also well shuffling. And this is one instance where we can apply it for directed graph symmetry. Now you might ask, okay, directed graph symmetry, what happens for undirected graph symmetry? But before we say that, let me take a quick detour and let me explain, like, what a block system is. So a block system is basically let's say we are given this G permutation group acting on D, then a partition B of let's say B1, B2 of Bn of this D. So we are given this domain, and a block system B is basically applies this way that for G, if B is G invariant. So more formally, this means that if you apply, let's say, a permutation on a block, then you get another block. So in a sense, like, it shuffles all the blocks and it shuffles all the entries in between. But whenever you apply any pi from your group, it basically shuffles your blocks, and entries inside it remains entries inside it. So one possible example could be, like, consider the action of, like, group of linear transformation on non-zero elements of vector space. Then if you think of lines, right, then all those lines which are going through origin, they form a block system. So now with the knowledge of block system, we can now say, like, what happens for undirected graph symmetries. Now, what is undirected graph symmetry, right? It is nothing but, let's say, my undirected graph symmetry, it is applying on N. So N is basically all possible edges of my undirected graph. I know that N is K times K minus 1 by 2, where K is the number of vertices. So permuting the vertices is inducing this permutation on the edges. Then we can actually have, we can prove this, which says that if you have a block system, let's say we have a G, a permutation group, which is basically applying on this block system of equal size, then you can have another permutation group H, which is now acting on this set K, okay, and which is induced by this G. Then we know that cost of H is lower bounded by cost of G. So using this, we can actually show that even for undirected graph properties, it's also well self-linked. And this is also intuitively easy to see, because what we need to do is, once we know that, okay, directed graph properties are well self-linked, then even for undirected graph properties, you can form a set which looks like x comma y and y comma x. So compute a block. So imagine a block where you have, like, each possible pair, like 1 comma 2 and 2 comma 1, right? Because in any undirected graph, we don't really have the direction. So in a sense, like, we put them in a box. And then when we put them in a box and then consider the action on those box, right, which doesn't look at the direction, So that's essentially this age that you are getting. So for this case, we only have like two blocks, like B1 and B2. And we have like many blocks, but each has like size two blocks. And then using this theorem, we can directly say that even for undirected graph symmetry, this is like factor power six related. Okay, any question on this? Okay, so I'll quickly mention, like, I mean, what happens for the other group symmetry case. But for that, let us just see like one more definition that we need, which is a base size. And base size is nothing but like if you look at the stabilizer of any set, like given any G permutation group on domain D, if you apply like so the pointwise stabilizer of any set is basically all those permutation such that it doesn't change it. So it is like identity, it acts as identity on them. Now with that, we can actually define base, which is if you let G be a permutation group on domain D, then a base is basically a set such that the pointwise stabilizer is a trivial group, okay? In other word, if you look at like let's say S is a base for G, then if you take any permutation and you look at the action of the permutation only on the base, then it already tells us, okay, how the action is going to be on the other elements. So essentially it suffices to look at the base. And we can then talk about the minimum base size, and we denote it by B of G. And then we have already seen like what is block system. With that, let us just pick up like one more definition, and then we can describe the result, which is like primitive group action. So what is a primitive group action? It is so G has to be a transitive group, and then we call it a primitive group if the only block system for G are either this set D or it partitions into singleton. Okay. In other word, it basically preserves like no non-trivial partitions of D. Okay, so let me now explain like what we can say for other group symmetries. So for other group actions, we can say that let's say G is a permutation group on N. Then you can choose any other function which is a partial function. Note that this function doesn't have to be related to G. Then you can design a partial function G which is symmetric under this capital G, which would have this property, meaning a quantum query complexity of this new function that you are designing, it is upper bounded by quantum query complexity of the function F that you have chosen. Note that it could be any function that you want, plus the base size, okay? And the randomized query complexity of G is lower bounded by randomized query complexity of F. Now, why is this important? Because if the base size is small, then you can essentially pick up any function of your choice. Let's say you take like any like Simon's problem, for instance, and you can then create a function G, which would be invariant under this group action G, and this would still preserve this exponential speedup. And then we can, so there could be like two kind of permutation groups. So for instance, for primitive groups, we can see like, okay, how this can help us. And then we'll talk about what happens for imprimitive group actions. So there is a theorem by Lee Back from 1984, which says that at least it can classify like how it's gonna behave for primitive group action. It says that for primitive groups, either the base size is going to be small, that we have defined like the base size in the last slide. So either it is small, or G contains symmetry, which is P uniform hypergraph. Now you already know like what happens in this class, in this case, right? We know that if it is a P uniform hypergraph property, then we cannot have exponential speedup. But on the other hand, if the base size is small, then you can actually essentially use this result to have a super polynomial speedup, depending on like what base size you have. So at least for the primitive permutation case, we can actually fully characterize like what happens for under any group action G, which is a primitive permutation group. So we know that, so we can basically make this distinction. We can say that if the base size of G is n to the small of O of one, then we can say that there exists a class of partial function F, which is symmetric under G, such that randomized and quantum are this related. On the other hand, if the base size of G is n to the omega one, then you can actually have a function for which then for all partial functions, you can show that these are polynomially related. So here in this case, we are saying that we can have a super polynomial speedup, but here in this case, we are seeing that they are essentially this case and they're essentially like polynomially related. So with this, let me tell you, like, I mean, what is the in general, like, what is the structure of all the results? Let's say we are given a permutation group action, then we know that either it has a small base size, then we know that okay, we can have super polynomial speedup. We can create a functions which can have super polynomial speedup, or it has large base size. Now, if it has large base size, then we can further classify into two categories, which are like primitive groups and imprimitive groups. And for primitive groups, using the theorem by Liebach, we can already know that this has to contain a p-uniform hypergraph. So then we know that we cannot have no larger speedup, meaning like no super polynomial speedup. So at least for the primitive case, this already tells like what happens for primitive case. But for imprimitive case, so let's say all the group actions which are imprimitive, you can actually look at like all their non-trivial block system, and you can actually then break them up into primitive groups. Okay, so and then you can look at like how many primitive groups are you getting, and we can show that if you are getting omega one primitive groups, then we can again like create a function which can exhibit large quantum speedup. On the other hand, if it is only constantly many primitive groups, then we can also show that if any of them, any of the primitives group that you are getting, if it has, if it is small in the sense that if the base size is small, then again you can put a function such that the overall functions that you are getting would have larger speedup, but only for this case we don't know. So essentially, like it almost characterizes like what happens. But this case is still like unsolved. So in a sense, like it already tells. So it already gives us a fine like a coarse grain analysis of what happens for all possible permutation groups. But fine grain analysis of this case are still remain to be done. I don't know, like how much time do I have? Maybe I can quickly explain the last result in 5-10 minutes.
Like another 10-ish minutes.
Oh, okay, that's
a little less. But yeah, we started a little late, so.
Oh, okay, all right, yeah, sure, thanks. Okay, in the rest of my time, let me actually explain the third result, which is actually coming up with a function like a property testing problem for which we can have exponential quantum speedup, and this is based on this problem, which is called welded tree problem. It's also known in the literature as glued tree problem. So this is basically given a length k binary tree and another length k binary tree, we glue them together this way. So we connect all the leaves. And essentially, they are connected by like alternating cycles here. So it could be more than one cycles. We already know. So this problem was studied by Childs, Glebe, Detto, Farhi, Gutmann, and Spillman in 2003, and they have shown that there is a quantum walk algorithm which, if you give entrance vertex, then it can find the exit exponentially faster than any classical algorithm. So it can actually traverse to the exit vertex in poly n time. So n is, let's say, the length of the tree. On the other hand, a classical randomized algorithm would take like exponential on n. Now, note that this property, even though this problem, even though it has like exponential gap between quantum and classical model, it's not a graph property problem, because here we are designating which node is an entrance node, which node is an exit node, and then if you try to relabel, it doesn't, the entrance doesn't remain an entrance. So first step, we want to turn it into a graph property problem such that it remains invariant under vertex relabeling. So we resolve this by connecting two other, so take this main graph, that this welded tree graph, and then we connect two other trees of same length, like length k. So let's say this is like length k tree glued with another length k tree. We take like two length k tree and connect them to the roots. So we call it an antenna graph. So this is an antenna graph, and this is a body graph. And we call this a candy graph because it looks like a candy. Now note that now you don't really need to tell like which one is entrance vertex, which one is exit, because you can tell from the context that okay, like the vertex which has degree 4, that's the root or that's one of the roots, entrance or exit. On the other hand, all the other vertex, they either have degree 3 or degree 1. Now so then this becomes a graph property problem. And but then so now what we can do is that now this time the roots are not defined, right? It's not, we are not given which one is entrance and which one is exit, but there is a simple way of finding root. You can randomly sample one vertex. If you randomly sample one, then with about half probability you land up in a vertex in the antenna section. And once you land in the antenna section, then you can actually traverse, and then you can come to the root. So you can actually find the root. And once you find the root, you can apply this quantum walk algorithm to find the other root. So for any quantum algorithm, it can actually find the root without even telling like which one is the root. So it can run this like few times, and then it can actually know whether you can reach like from root to like one root to the other using a quantum algorithm. But note that this is still not a graph property testing problem, and we want to have a property testing problem. So we did like bunch of tricks. First of all, we had like many copies of this candy graph. So in our original graph, we'll have like many, exponentially many disjoint copies of the candy graph. So right now I'm just describing you what would be an yes instance. So in the yes instance, there would be all possible many possible candy graphs, and so many candy graphs, and then we also allow self loops and parallel edges, and there is a reason for that. We want self loops and parallel edges to give advice. Now, what is advice? So advice is something which would actually help us knowing which would be the weld vertex. So for instance, if you look at this glued tree graph, then these vertex are called the weld vertex. On the other hand, all these vertices are like internal, like body vertex or like antenna vertex. So we use the self loop and parallel edges for this reason, that given this candy graphs, we take like almost, let's say, half of the candy graphs of all possible candy graphs that we have, and give one of the root a self loop. So let's say we select this and either maybe give a self loop here or here. So we do this with half of the graph. And with the other half of the graph, we either give both of the roots a self loop, or we don't give any of them a self loop. Meaning this way we are denoting So self loops are used as are marking a vertex. So for instance, when we say that this route, let's say, has a self loop, we say that this is marked. On the other hand, if no routes has a self loop, then no one is marked. On the other hand, if both of them has, then both of them are marked. And then we also do another trick, which is from any node in the body. So this is called the body of the Candy graph. So from any node in the body, we connect a double edge. So it's like a parallel edge to one of the antenna vertex. And so why do we do that? Because we do that to denote which vertex is in the weld and which vertex is not in the weld. And the way we do that is, let's say we take a vertex from the weld, then this vertex would be connected to an antenna vertex of some graph, which would have only one root marked. On the other hand, if it is a body vertex, not the weld vertex, then this will have edge to an antenna vertex of a candy graph, which would have either both of the roots marked or none of them to be marked. So in a sense, like, why does it help us? Because then if you can, from any vertex, if you can go through this node, and then somehow if you can traverse this graph from one root to the other, then if you check that both of them are marked or not, then that can already tell you whether this vertex where you have started with, whether that vertex is a weld vertex or not. And then the property we define is, we say that, so we have this double edges, and then we say that a graph has property PK if it's single edges. So the property is defined in terms of the single edges. So you ignore all the self loops and all these double edges. So if you consider only the single edges, then they form a graph that contains 2j times 2 to the k minus 1 disconnected instances of candy graphs. And that's a one instance. And a no instance would be any other graph which is epsilon far away from such graph. Now you might ask, like, why we are doing this fancy thing, like why we are connecting this. It is for the fact that for this particular property, if all the welded trees, like welded vertices, are marked, then all those welded vertices, if they are marked, then even for a classical algorithm, it is easy. The classical algorithm could actually traverse, and then if it knows that, okay, this is a weld vertex, then it can be actually pointed in the right direction, and it can actually go towards the other route. And then the classical algorithm can run on all the vertex in the graph, and it can know whether we have this many disconnected candy graphs or not. So if you mark all the welded vertices, then it becomes easy even for a classical algorithm. But note one crucial thing is that we are marking it in a slightly different, difficult way, in the sense that it is slightly difficult for a classical algorithm, because let's say this vertex, we want to know whether it is marked or not. In order to know that, I need to go to this antenna vertex, and then I need to check whether there is a path from, so then I need to check whether both of these are marked or not. Like, I need to check the parity of this information, like how many of the roots are marked. And doing that would actually require me to traverse this graph. And I know that a quantum algorithm can do this faster than the classical one. Like, quantum algorithm can do it like exponentially faster than the classical one. So starting from here, a quantum algorithm can actually find this advice exponentially faster. On the other hand, a classical algorithm would not actually find this, would find difficulty finding this advice. So that's why, this advice is essentially is just telling, like, which vertices are marked. Okay, so that's why for quantum algorithm, it is very easy to figure out, like, which vertices are marked, and then it can quickly check the property that, okay, this is whether this is this many disjoint candy graphs or not. On the other hand, For a classical algorithm, it is hard. And for the lower bound techniques, we have actually, like, for the classical lower bound, we have actually, like, the for the zero instance, we have actually took a distribution over this kind of looking graph, where this graphs are actually self-welded. So if you don't know if the advice is hard to read, then for a classical algorithm, even if it is here, for it, it's not. It's hard to tell whether it is actually coming back to the same graph or it's actually going to the other side. So it's actually very hard to tell for a classical algorithm whether it's a candy graph or not. So classically, we can show that this property is actually hard to compute, like exponentially hard to compute than the quantum algorithm.
So Pathak, we're now close to the 1 hour mark, so it would be good to...
Okay, all right, all right. So I just need like one more minute just to say the open question. Okay, so first of all, as I was telling, like this fine grain analysis of this part is remained. So this could be done, and then we can fully characterize like what happens for any permutation groups. And then the second open question could be, so we are exhibiting a function for which we know that there is exponential speed up, and that too for graph property property testing problem. But the thing is, this is really like a cooked up problem, right? It's not it's not we cannot claim that this has any practical application. So one possible open question could be, can we still show such exponential speed up for maybe some practical property testing problem in the adjacency list model? And finally, before I stop, I should say, like, obviously, like, we are talking about graph properties, but then an interesting question could be, what happens for super polynomial speed up for monotone graph properties? Like what happens for monotone graph properties? Meaning those properties which remain satisfied, even if we start with a one instance, we keep on adding edges to it, and then it still remains one. Note that, I mean, this graph is not such instance, right? If you keep adding one, it will destroy the candy graph structure. So what happens for those kind of graph properties? And then finally, the other thing is, like, I mean, what are the exact like are these bounds tied that we are getting for our randomized and quantum query complexity for graph properties? We know that for P uniform hypergraph, we are showing that this is like 3P, but then we're not even for P equal to 1, we don't know whether this is tied, because on one hand we can show that for graph properties it is like power 6. Even for symmetries, like for P equal to 1, we know that randomized and quantum are power 3 related. But if you want to find an explicit problem, then we know that for OR function, for instance, it's like power 2 related. So there is this still like power 2 versus 3 gap. So even for P equal to 1 case, we don't know. So yeah, with that, I would actually stop here. Thank you. Thank you for your attention.
Thanks a lot, Suprata, for a very interesting talk. Do we have any questions?
Hi, Michael. Yes.
I have one.
I think Michael has one. He has raised his hand.
Oh, sorry, Michael. Go ahead.
Was just the clapping symbol.
Oh, I see. Okay. I actually have a question. Can you go back two slides? Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Sorry. This, yeah, I'm like, I want to talk about this or ask something about this diagram with this kind of classification of like the permutation group and whether it has small, large base size, etc. So if you take an arbitrary permutation group acting on the vertices of a graph, which then induces an action on the edges, is it easy to determine where that permutation group will fall in this?
So for instance, if you take like any arbitrary permutation which is acting on the vertices, you can try to see whether it is already well shuffling or not. If that is already well shuffling, then you know that you can reduce it to which we induces on the edge set. But so for instance, like just for general graph property, we know that it is a full symmetry on the vertices, So that's why it's also full symmetry. That's why it's also power polynomially related for the induced symmetry that you are getting on the edges. But yeah, like if you are not starting with, let's say, SN on the vertex symmetry, then sure, first you need to check whether there is whether that is already well suffering or not, because essentially like all these results are a reduction to collision in a sequence of reduction.
Can you remind us how does well shuffling fit into this classification?
Oh, right. So well shuffling is nothing but it is about distinguishing a permutation from the group action that you have considered from a small range function. And then if the cost of doing that, like quantumly, if it is like polynomially related based on R, so that's exactly the well shuffling property that we have defined. So if I go back.
Yeah, if you could flash the definition once more, that would be helpful.
So yeah. So well shuffling property is nothing but you take like so let's say you take any G, we say that this is well shuffling. If let's say well shuffling with power A, if this happens, like any quantum query complexity, so quantum query complexity of distinguishing a permutation from G and a string from DNR, which means that a query complexity of distinguishing between a permutation from G and a small range function, if this requires at least this quantity, then we call it a well shuffling property. And you know, like this is exactly So for instance, if you go back here, like in this case, right? So you know that here we are talking about SN, and we know that if you take a random permutation from SN, and then if you want to distinguish with a small range function, then that's actually polynomially related because it's like 1/1/3. So that's why it's well shuffling with the power 3. So that's why like for SN, it's like well shuffling with power 3. So given any permutation, you just need to look at whether it satisfies this quantity for any R.
Okay, but if I have a permutation group, I don't have the full symmetric group, just some permutation group, and I know that it's well shuffling, I don't care whether the action is primitive, et cetera, like that result is independent of these.
Yeah, so if you know if it is well shuffling, then you can already use this theorem and you can show that they're polynomially related.
Right. Okay.
On the other hand, if it is not well shuffling, let's say you cannot show this is well shuffling, then you can try to maybe analyze the other structure. Like maybe we can then go into this classification that we
have. Right, and like go down that tree and see.
That's right, and then see where it exactly fits.
Okay, thanks. Any other questions? A couple of people have already left. It's a little late. If not, then let's maybe end the official part of the talk and thank Supath again for a very nice talk.
Thank you. Thank you for your attention.